Thank you for listening to Mormon Sex Info. This episode is an archived episode and is only now becoming publicly available. Mormon Sex Info relies on contributions. To contribute, please visit mormonsex.info. And now, please enjoy this episode.
And welcome to a co-production between Mormon Sex Info and Mormon Mental Health Podcasts. This is Natasha Helfer-Parker, and I'm excited to get started with our interview tonight. Before I do that, I just want to give a quick shout out to all of you who have heeded the call to start some donations headed towards Mormon Mental Health Podcast. I very much appreciate that. We've had several this last few months since I've been, I guess, asking more directly. We need to make this podcast sustainable financially if it's going to continue past 2018. And it's just been really heartwarming to hear so many people talk about or start giving me feedback about how meaningful these podcasts have been for them. So I appreciate all those comments. I appreciate the donations and continue to ask or more. Even though we've had some, we're nowhere near making it sustainable yet. So please, if you're finding these podcasts valuable, please consider donating mormonmentalhealthpodcast.org. Right-hand side, there's a button. It's all very easy for you to be able to do that, either a one-time donation or doing it kind of like a subscription, like monthly. So thank you for that. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest tonight. This is Bryce Cook. And he is a founding member of ALL, A-L-L, which stands for Arizona LDS LGBT, Friends and Family, and a co-director of the annual All Are Alike Unto God Conference, which is held every April in Mesa, Arizona. He's married to Sarah Spencer Cook, and together they have six kiddos, two of whom are gay. And since their oldest son came out publicly in 2012, Bryce and Sarah have become public allies for LGBT people in and out of the church. Bryce is a graduate from BYU with a degree in finance and from ASU with an MBA. He's an economic consultant. I had the pleasure of staying in your home, I think last year sometime. I think I was there for Sunstone and several things that were happening in Arizona, and it was a lovely stay. So thank you for your hospitality. Got to meet some of these great kids that you have, and it was a very fun family.
It was a fun time.
It was great family energy that you have in your home. And I'll just also say that you're a believing, active member of the church. And with that, is there anything else that you want to introduce yourself about, or have I done it all for you?
I think you gave a very good introduction. You don't need to hear any more about me.
Okay. All right. Well, the reason why I'm having you on the show is that while I was in your home and visiting with you, you were telling me about a document that you had, I think at the time, maybe just finished, and we're getting ready to publish. And this article is called, What Do We Know of God's Will for His LGBT Children? An Examination of the LDS Church's Position on Homosexuality. So we talked about it for a little bit, and I had told you at the time that I'd probably be interested in interviewing you about it. And since then, I've had a chance to read it. And I find this really a beneficial article. You go ahead and compare it to the 1973 article that was published in Dialogue by Lester Bush in regards to the priesthood and temple ban on people of African descent, as far as some of the arguments he was making at the time as to why we have this current position. And so you kind of used that as a maybe template or an example of what you were trying to do. Is that a good way to start talking about this project and what led you to write it?
Yes. The Lester Bush article was definitely a model, and I don't think I could compare my work to his. His really was really groundbreaking. Mine was not quite so academic. I started out writing it purely academic with hopes of getting it published in Dialogue. And indeed, it was published in Dialogue, this summer edition. But I thought as I wrote, I didn't want it to be too dry and too academic, because I wanted it to, to touch people's hearts. I wanted them to feel a little bit what I felt, although I did try to maintain an objective, dispassionate tone. I didn't want it to be too dry. So anyway, I tried to strike a balance between completely academic and, a personal account, and hopefully succeeded somewhat in doing that. But yes, Lester Bush's groundbreaking article was my model. I thought someone needs to write something for LGBT people that looks at why the church has taken the position it's taken. And is that position really of God? What do we know historically? What do we know doctrinally? What do we know from a moral basis? And what do we observe empirically that leads us to believe that our current position is really God's will? And I thought someone's going to write that article someday, and no one ever did. So I thought, well, I'll sit down and start typing it. And it took me about a good 6-7 months to get it all finished. And some of you probably wish it hadn't taken so long because it ended up being a long paper. But I needed to get everything out there that I thought needed to be addressed properly. And anyway, that's the genesis of it.
Well, you did, I think, an excellent job of going through the kind of the history and some of the stances that leaders in our church have taken and how those stances have changed over time. They're nowhere near, I think, where neither you nor I would want to see those stances be. But I think what you're doing here is very respectfully sharing some of the ways that these things have changed, precedents for other doctrines that have changed that have nothing to do with LGBT issues, and then also maybe some of the reasons why we see a need for change. So we're going to kind of go through those things here through this interview, if you don't mind. And is there anything that you want to say before we go further, just as far as your hopes or your, you know, what do you hope this article, what do you hope the impact is?
Right. The main thing I wanted it to do was to provoke sincere questioning and thinking. I'm not doing it to club the church or to embarrass it or to criticize the leaders or to try and push them. But I do want it to push people, members, everyone, to think a little bit. Why do we believe the way we believe? Why do we have the positions we have? And if people will at least think about that and really sincerely question or consider all the questions that I raise in this paper, then I feel that the mission will be accomplished. And then I will allow the Lord's Spirit to work on individuals and on the leaders of the church to make the right decisions, because I believe in the end, you know, the truth will come out and the right will prevail. And I would hope that that will happen sooner rather than later, because, you know, while things are in flux and while people are wondering, then that's when we have lots of problems. And certainly we see that our LGBT brothers and sisters are suffering greatly with the church's position now. Now, I know that sounds a little biased too, like, well, my conclusion is already reached. And I will say up front, yes, my conclusion based on years of study and prayer and meditation and thinking and writing, I have come to a conclusion for myself personally as to how I feel. And I think that's pretty clear in the paper.
Yes.
But I leave it to everyone to reach their own conclusion and to think about the questions that I raise, given the observations that I make and the things that the paper covers.
Yeah, thank you. And I will back you on those conclusions myself. I mean, I too am a member and have been for years treating people in these situations, which is what led me to those conclusions changing and those ideas changing, right? Because of many of the things that you're talking about here. So let's dive into this. Let's start with kind of where your paper starts, which is the historical background.
Right.
And maybe even before we get to the historical background, would you be willing to just kind of paraphrase what the current position of the church is, as far as just basic, and then we'll go into some of the ways that that has changed.
Certainly. So right now there are two, I think, underlying core principles that the church espouses as part of its position on homosexuality. The first is that being homosexual is not a choice and it's not a sin. However, acting on it is, even if it's in a lawful committed marriage. And then secondly, marriage can only be between a man and a woman, and is, you know, that's the way God ordained it to be. So that, I would say, succinctly describes the church's position.
And it's always interesting to me how many people still are not clear about that very first thing that you said, because really that's a shift we've seen fairly recently, I would say in the last 15 years or so, that being homosexual is not a choice or a sin, but acting on it is. I think that everybody is
right. Yeah, absolutely. In President Kimball's era, just the fact of being homosexual was considered a grave sin. They didn't distinguish between acting on homosexuality and being homosexual. And of course, they thought that it was absolutely a choice, that it was a moral weakness or failing that some people, for whatever reason, were susceptible to. And it could be repented of, and you know, that course of their susceptibility could be changed with God's help and maybe with counseling and psychological help. But now the church has completely reversed its position from those teachings and ideas a number of years ago.
Yeah, and that's not, I mean, putting it into historical context, that's not uncommon that, you know, most of society in the prior to the 1970s would have seen homosexuality in that way, at least here in the United States. So that it was considered a mental health disorder. It was, you know, in the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, it was actually like a diagnosis that you could be given, which that was backtracked in the early 70s in the psychological fields. But this isn't something that just the Mormons, you know, were thinking this way. This was pretty much the bias of the current psychological and medical times.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And that's one reason why it raises the questions that I have put in this paper is, you know, does our position really just stem from cultural belief and tradition? Because you're right, the church position in the 50s and 60s, which is when it first began to really become talked about and addressed by church leaders, primarily President Kimball, the church was in lockstep with cultural belief and even the psychological and medical fields until, like you say, the early 70s, once psychologists began doing studies and really listening and talking to LGBT people, then they understood that, you know, this wasn't a choice. It was not a psychological disorder and that they could live normal and happy lives just, you know, the same as straight people. And so they removed it as a disorder, as you said, from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. You know, the culture was kind of slow to adopt, but it gradually, through the 70s and 80s, you know, gay people began to get more and more attention in the media. A lot of it was still negative, but little by little, society began to change. But the church stayed really firmly in the, this is not acceptable, it's a choice, it's wrong, and it will never be acceptable before God. And so the church really stayed about 20 years behind the rest of society. But then as society moved, the church would move a little bit, but still always kind of 20 years behind until, you know, gay marriage in this era, in the last 5-10 years, society has gone from the majority not accepting homosexuality and gay marriage to now the majority accepting. The church also has seen tremendous change in acceptance of homosexuality. I'm talking church membership there, by the way, as reflected in polls and surveys, but still quite a bit behind the rest of society in its acceptance.
Yeah, and right away, I'm going to apologize to any listeners who are in the T category, because we're using the term LGBT, and really what we're talking about mostly here is LG and maybe B. As far as a lot of these quotes and things, it's not that the T population isn't also affected, obviously, by many of these concepts, but much of the conversation has been around same-sex attraction and homosexuality. Not so much of the conversation has been on gender identity, even within the church. I think there's been very little about that, which I actually see kind of as a mixed blessing. In other words, there isn't a lot of, I think, understanding about it, nor conversation about it, which means that hopefully when we start having more dialogue about that, we won't have all of this, you know, backlash to kind of undo when it comes to.
Yeah, thank you so much for that clarification. And sometimes I throw around those acronyms, LGBT, too loosely. This paper, as the title says is really an examination of the church's position on homosexuality, and it does not address transgender. And I, you know, I would love to do that at some point. I'm still learning about that aspect of it, and I've learned a lot in the last couple of years, but the paper really is focused on homosexuality. So I appreciate you making that clear.
I have to remind myself too. I think we all kind of, LGBT is just kind of a very common, like you said, acronym that most of us use, and sometimes we forget what exactly we're talking about. Yeah. And anyway, yeah. All right, so let's go right into the evolution that you really do a good job of, even bringing up some quotes that I'd like to just read here. So the first one is it a choice? And you kind of addressed this already, but some of the quotes that we had, like from Kimball back in 1969, he states, many have been misinformed that they are powerless in the matter, not responsible for the tendency, and that God made them that way. This is as untrue as any other of the diabolical lies Satan has concocted. It is blasphemy. Man is made in the image of God. Does the pervert think God to be that way? Quote, unquote, that way. And then Packer in 1976 states, there's a falsehood that some are born with an attraction to their own kind, with nothing they can do about it. They are just, again, quote, that way. That is a malicious and destructive lie. While it is a convincing idea to some, it is of the devil. No one is locked into that kind of life. So let's go forward into present. And these are all things that you, well, both of these quotes are just from the MormonandGay.org website. So I'm not sure they're tied to a particular individual. But it says, even though individuals do not choose to have such attractions, they do choose how to respond to them. So that's different than what was being said before. And while same-sex attraction is not a sin, it can be a challenge. While one may not have chosen to have these feelings, he or she can commit to keep God's commandments. So again, where it stays the same is the expectation to not act, but there's quite a difference of tone in whether or not it's been a chosen thing or not.
Right.
You want to speak any more about those?
Yeah. Just real briefly, I think that is so important because there are still members of the church. I think many members, maybe, who knows, the majority, at least of older generation, that don't know that, that don't believe that really. And they need to hear that from the church and understand that the church teaches it is not a choice. And if they could understand that one thing, I think that would go a long way towards helping them be a little bit more empathetic and accepting of gay people.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've noticed recently, as the sexuality field advances in its understanding of human beings in general, there's been a lot of talk about there being a spectrum of orientation and attraction and erotic templates and preferences, you know, all of this language that I'm kind of around all the time at these conferences, because what we do know about the human condition in general is that there can be a certain level of fluidity. I understand what we're talking about in the sexuality field because obviously people are very diverse. Their stories are diverse. Things change, you know, your 20s are very different than your 60s, etc. However, what I've noticed is that the religious right or conservative religions like ours will take quotes like that and will actually go back to see, it can be changed. We're fluid. And so they kind of use this new language that we're using in the sexuality field to almost come back to this idea of choice. And again, it's not even in the sexuality field. We're not talking about people choosing their fluidity. We just notice fluidity. And that for some people, that's still very much in a very small spectrum, you know, so that as a heterosexual, for example, I may not have liked oral sex in my 20s. I may like it very much in my 40s, you know, but that does, so there's fluidity in my ideas or in my things that I enjoy or not enjoy. That doesn't mean that all of a sudden my entire orientation is fluid. Does that make sense? So I want to just point that out for people to be careful to not buy into that. Oh, see, we were right all along because now the sexuality field is talking about fluidity. That was just right. A tangent on my part.
So. No, that's a good point because I've heard that brought up as well. There are some articles by, I think it was a U of U professor, a woman that talks about that, and her articles have been mischaracterized and misconstrued. So yeah, that's important you bring that up.
Okay. All right. So the next question that you pose is this idea of whether or not it's curable. And so let's go through some of the quotes here. Kimball, again, in 1969, says, after consideration of the evil aspects, the ugliness and prevalence of the evil of homosexuality, the glorious thing to remember is that it is curable and forgivable. Certainly, it can be overcome. And marriage to the opposite sex was a solution back then. In fact, I think that, you know, I usually gauge it that if my clients are anywhere above the age of 35 currently, that they were probably given some type of, I guess, recommendation to marry the opposite gender.
Right. All right.
But now, as far as, again, on mormonandgay.org, which, by the way, is a site that is tied to the LDS Church. There's plenty of people that really don't believe it is, but it is. It says a change in attraction should not be expected or demanded as an outcome by parents or leaders. And then Holland in 2015 says, I must say the son's sexual orientation did not somehow miraculously change. No one assumed it would. So do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Right. Yeah, that was his talk about, I think it was about mothers, as I recall. And he had like three or four different stories. And this one was about a missionary who came home from his mission early because he had, in Elder Holland's words, same-sex attraction. And everyone who, you know, understands gay people and who are advocates were really happy to hear him make this statement. You know, when he said, I must say this son's sexual orientation did not somehow miraculously change. No one assumed it would. And that's exactly the position that the new MormonandGay.org takes, you know, that it's not to be expected. They recognize now they've got testimony of thousands of gay members of the church who have said, you know, all the praying in the world and all the temple going and fasting and, you know, religious observance does not change it. So the church has finally accepted that position.
And I know there's been some research to show that people who are saying those things have tried those things much more so than those of us who are heterosexual. In other words, their willingness to live up to those things almost becomes like an obsession, like almost scrupulosity or stuff. So where they're praying and reading the scriptures and fasting for much longer times than is typical for the rest of us because they're so desperate to have these promises, you know, after all that you can do, you know, which is very Mormon of us to think, well, if it's not changing, then it must be me not doing enough. So these are not people who are taking those statements lightly, is just what I would add to that. So let's talk about what are the doctrinal reasons. Like, you bring up just kind of an overlook at the canon, right? The scriptures.
Yeah.
So what basis do we have for all of these positions on scripture?
Right. So again, looking at the church's position, which is currently it's okay to be gay, just don't act on it. Even if you're in a legal, monogamous, loving marriage, that is, you know, that is not okay. That is still sinful in the church's eyes. In fact, it's a grievous sin in the church's eyes, according to what some of the apostles have said. So where do we get this position from the scriptures? If you look in the scriptural canon, there's nothing in our LDS canon, that is the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, that says anything about homosexuality. And it's not addressed by Jesus in any of the Gospels. There are two main biblical passages that Christianity cites to primarily evangelicals, Leviticus 18 and Romans 1. And we don't need to get into the verses. They're known as the clobber passages, but you know, they basically prohibit homosexual sex. And we could get into a discussion of how many biblical scholars think that this is way overreaching interpretation to say that that prohibits same-sex marriage. And I talk about this a little in my paper, and I would agree with that, because both of those passages didn't say anything about same-sex marriage because it didn't exist until just, you know, the last 10 or 20 years, really. And they were decrying practices really that were also engaged in by heterosexuals. You know, whether that was master-slave sex in the Roman era or, you know, armies in the ancient world for generations when they looted the vanquished towns would often, you know, engage in sex with the men to humiliate them. As long as you were not the one being penetrated, it wasn't seen as being odd or different. So anyway, that was a little bit of a tangent to get into the explanation of the biblical passages. But here's what's interesting. None of our church positions or doctrines in any of the documents that the church relies on, including in its most current explication of its position, which is mormonandgay.org, that has the teachings of the church, nothing refers to these two biblical passages. So you ask any basic Christian evangelical, how do you know that God prohibits gays from having sex or being married? They will bring up those two passages. Most Mormon members probably would too if they're familiar with those scriptures. But the church leaders, when you look at their talks, and I did a survey of all the talk, the conference talks in the last 50 years or so, and have an appendix in my paper that shows how many times these verses have been brought up. And it's only like two or three times, and it's not even in the context of saying this is why we don't believe that homosexuality is acceptable to God. They're kind of tangential and just footnoted. So if our basis is not based on these biblical scriptures, then we have to go to modern day teachings. What do we have in modern day revelation or teachings of the church that justifies the church's position if it's not based on these Bible verses? Well, basically, we have the proclamation on the family, which we see Elder Oaks is really trying to establish that that is the basis for our teaching in his last conference talk in October. We have several other documents that actually do a better job of explaining the doctrine. One in particular is called the Divine Institution of Marriage that came about originally after or at the time of Prop 8. And gave all the churches religious justifications for why same-sex marriage is not of God. But what you see in these modern-day teachings and responses is that they really came about as a defensive response to societal change and to change in potential laws in government. They did not come about as church leaders praying to Heavenly Father and saying, Heavenly Father, how can we help our gay members? How can we understand how they fit in thy, you know, plan of salvation or in the kingdom? You know, it was all, how do we prevent homosexuality from infiltrating the church? How do we prevent same-sex marriage from becoming acceptable, you know, this horrendous sin? That's where the positions have originated from. And so that's another reason why in this paper I am trying to say, let's look at this from a position of love and empathy as opposed to a defensive posture on how to prevent same-sex marriage, because that's really where our doctrines have originated.
Well, and I think a lot of people think that the proclamation, the family proclamation, was somehow way before Prop 8, and therefore it was like this great almost quote-unquote revelation, you know, preparing for things like Prop 8. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is that actually the legal issue is already happening in the state of Hawaii, as well as other countries like Canada, I forget now which other ones, but right in that time of the mid-90s, which is when the proclamation came out. So it's absolutely correct that this was in response to legal things that were happening either in our country or others.
Right.
So it was not, you know, it wasn't like 10 years before the first Prop 8. Prop 8 was several things down the road.
Yeah.
It's one that got the most news or that most people were aware of. Most people were not aware of the church's involvement in the Hawaii legal action.
Yeah, the Hawaii legislation was in the mid-90s. 95 is when the proclamation came out, if I'm not mistaken. And then Prop 8 was 2008, quite a few years later.
Right.
But the church, all in that time frame up through 2008, was very involved publicly in opposing same-sex marriage legislation, in trying to get members to oppose it, to donating money, and being involved in political lobbying. And then after 2008, after Prop 8, the church got such a black eye publicly for its involvement and even got fined for some illegal contributions or not abiding by full disclosure laws, that they totally retreated from public opposition. And from that point on, they really just encouraged the members to defend religious freedom. And that sort of became the big watch cry, as well as they have continued behind the scenes to hire law firms and lobbying firms to file amicus briefs. Like in the cake bake shop case, they filed an amicus brief. They did in the Supreme Court Obergefell matter. So they continue to fund, legal opposition to same-sex marriage, but they don't go real public in opposition to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So we were talking about the doctrinal basis and how it's not based on the biblical scriptures. It's based on the church's current arguments, which have originated out of political positions. And so now, if you'd like, I can talk just real briefly about what the key theological arguments are that the church makes in opposition to it.
Yeah, and right before we go into that, I would just like to point out that in October 2010, you state this, and I remember this happening, it was Packer who said in one of his talks that the Family Proclamation was a revelation, and actually that was taken out of his talk, because it is important to understand that the Family Proclamation, as it stands today, is not canonized, and actually wasn't even written by the First Presidency or the Apostles, is my understanding.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of cloudiness associated with its origination. Elder Oakes kind of tried to clarify that in his last talk without getting into specifics, but that's correct that it originated originally out of, it appears, the church's opposition to the Hawaii legislation for same-sex marriage. But regardless of why it originated, the church leaders are still going to say it's an inspired document. They're still going to say that, it represents the church's theological basis for why it believes in traditional families. You know, I see a lot of people trying to sweep it away because it was because of the purpose that it originated. And I get that. But, as long as the church claims it was still inspired, it's kind of hard to debate.
It's going to be their position.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. You are correct.
So the theological arguments the church makes, there are three main points. One is that the church's position is based on eternal marriage and eternal progression and procreation. Mm-hmm. So this continuation of the seeds idea. And that assumes that the sealing of a husband and wife is the crowning ordinance of all the priesthood ordinances. The sealing in the temple is, this crowning ordinance. But because that has such a high place in our church, it's, I think, generated this implicit belief that there's no room for or deviation from man-woman sealing, that that's all there is, just because that's the way it's originated over time. And this takes a very literal approach, particularly this procreation in the next life. I mean, what do we really know about how procreation works in the next life? I mean, do we really think it's going to be like the primitive biological evolutionary development that, that we use to create our species in this life, that we use to procreate in this life? I mean, we just know nothing about, if we had, another millions of years of, evolution and development to the point where we were like a super intelligent post-mortal being like God, how do we know what gender's like or what procreation's like? And I think we just, being the creatures of limited imagination and mind that we are, the analogy I use is trying to understand God in the next life for us is akin to us trying to explain our existence and life to an ant. An ant just doesn't have the capacity to understand, or the intelligence or the experience or the physical sensation and ability to understand anything about our life. It can, it can understand warmth and heat and light and pheromones and things like that. And in the same way, I think God, has to use really primitive means to communicate with us, who are very primitive probably in our development, to explain what his life and the next life is going to be like. And so whenever we take our life and our experience and superimpose it onto God's life and what the hereafter is like, you know, I think we just, we get way off base and we go too far. So thinking that procreation is, you know, all about having babies and having sex the same way we do now, you know, who can say, who knows? I just think we're reaching too far.
Well, two thoughts I have, one of which you talk about and one I don't know, but if I remember correctly, like in deeper Mormon doctrine, there's even like three levels within the celestial kingdom level.
Yeah.
And I think that it was like, to get to the top level, you had to be like in a relationship, you know, where you're sealed. I don't know. So like you're saying, a lot of that, I think, is speculation. What I find really kind of interesting or beautiful about Mormon doctrine in this regard is that we definitely left the heaven and hell rhetoric, right? Yeah. Like these two binaries, right. Like we left that behind and we kind of, you know, whether it's the telestial or terrestrial or celestial or the three within the celestial, like there's all this at least room for paradisical glory within a huge realm of possibilities.
Right.
And so I think that, yeah, sometimes we kind of, there's still that binary, like puritanical gene in all of us that likes to go back to the heaven or hell approach, right? You're either in or you're not, instead yeah. of the invitation within Mormonism to see it as a more expansive, ongoing journey that I think is potentially there doctrinally.
Right.
But regardless of that, because that's not really what's super important here, I think your point of procreation, well, many of us are in marriages heterosexually that have nothing to do with procreation, right? So that really falls short for me. And right. you mentioned this in your article, you know, yes. that we can get married in our 60s. I mean, the apostles are getting remarried. They're not having new babies, you know, in their 80s. There's plenty of people who, for medical reasons, adopt or have infertility issues or whatever. Procreation is not really the primary reason we get married anymore. The primary reason we get married is because we fall in love and we want a loving relationship and a loving partnership and a companionship throughout our lives. And then hopefully, you know, babies will come, but if they don't, we'll find other ways to raise a family. Or if we get divorced or have death, and then we get remarried. So that really falls short.
Right. And that, yeah, that's one of the questions that my paper raises is, you know, the church cites procreation as being an essential purpose of marriage. And yet it allows these couples that you mentioned, whether it's couples who are past childbearing years or those who are medically unable to conceive, it allows them to marry purely for love and companionship. So why can't we allow that same dispensation for gay couples? Why can't we allow them to marry purely for love and companionship, even if it's for time only, if that's all the church can do for right now, you know, rather than say it's a grievous sin?
So and can you talk about, before we move on to the other arguments, I think this is maybe a good place to insert some of the thoughts you wrote about in regards to celibacy, because celibacy right. is the option, right, that we give to gay members, but that doesn't create children either. So either way, there's no children.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's like, it's a kind of a funny catch-22 argument because, yeah, the church says, you know, you can't marry because you're unable to procreate. So what's our answer for you? You need to live a celibate life. And as a celibate, as a person living in celibacy, you know, you can't procreate either. So it's kind of a funny argument to make that. And what's interesting about the celibacy argument, which is really the only path now the church explicitly
approves,
recommends. Yeah. Because they, I mean, individuals may try to make a mixed orientation marriage work and the church will be okay with that, they don't push that anymore because they recognize how difficult and challenging that can be and how unfair that is. I mean, really, if, you know, those of us who have children, would we want our daughter, our son to marry someone of the opposite sex who is gay? You know, it's not fair to them or to the gay person.
There, it rings to me that because we can empathize with the heterosexual member, that that's why it's been less recommended,
Yeah.
Because we're not empathizing with, you know, the LGBT people. Right. And so, but we are empathizing with the heterosexual member who's now in a mixed orientation marriage. So let's not push that anymore. We wouldn't want the poor woman or the poor man to be in that position.
Right. Yeah. You know, the recent Josh Weed post that he and his wife Lolly posted about their divorce, she really expressed that, I thought, beautifully. That, you know, all these people said, oh, yeah, I can understand why you're doing this, Lolly. It's so unfair of you to be in this marriage where you don't feel loved and desired. You know, that's just so unfair to you. And she says, well, I'm glad you can see that from my perspective, but it's, can you see why that's also unfair, you know, to the gay person, to Josh, that it's unfair for him to be in a marriage where he doesn't feel that desire and that love and that connection. So yeah, it's important to be able to see it both ways.
Yeah. Okay. So then the next, well, and then also just to finish up the celibacy argument, there's nothing supporting celibacy as an option again, from
right.
a scriptural in fact, perspective.
Yeah, what's interesting about celibacy is that past church leaders, particularly McConkie, who, you know, was really outspoken about the Catholic Church's apostasy and its improper and undoctrinal ways, you know, cites celibacy as a very apostate doctrine. And, well, as members of the church, we all know from Genesis and Moses and the temple that it's not good that man should be alone, that God wants us to pair up. So celibacy is not a good condition for humans generally to be in. But for whatever reason, you know, the church feels that that's the only position that a gay person can be in.
Right. And we'll get into some of the effects of this later. But for right now, we're just presenting
the doctrinal
arguments. Okay. So then the next argument that you state is the complementarianism. It's a long word. Argument. Yeah. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this gender essentialism or gender complementarity or complementarianism is really gender roles, that, you know, men are masculine and there are certain roles that they should aspire to, and women, you know, have this feminine side. And the church really defines this as being, you know, an eternal perspective. In the proclamation on the family, I mean, we can see it right there, that men are to provide and protect and women are primarily the nurturers. So the church has really bought into this idea, and you know, they hold to this as doctrine. And so they say that two men or two women cannot satisfy this complementarity that should exist in a home and a family, and particularly in raising children. Now, one argument that I make against that is that even in a heterosexual marriage, you may not have the full complement of masculine and feminine. You know, what about a man who is somewhat feminine in his demeanor and is not aggressive, and, you know, someone who likes sports, or, you know, and all those typical manly things. What if he's more tender and nurturing and engender some of the what are considered to be feminine characteristics? You know, how does that relate then to having the full complement of, you know, this gender complementarity? Another argument I make is not in the paper, but that I've often thought about, you know, where the church says a child is entitled to having a mother and a father because they think, you know, masculine and feminine are necessary, you know, for the complementarity in the rearing of children. But you could say that, what about if a particular parent has a handicap? And I'm not saying this to say that, you know, gay people are handicapped in any way, but to make this point, what if a parent, for instance, say a mother was deaf, would weigh in and say, oh, no, has, you know, the right and is entitled to be raised by parents who can hear and hear their cries, because, wow, that is a big safety concern if a parent couldn't hear its child's cry. You know, they'd never weigh in on that. Or let's say a husband was in a wheelchair, was, you know, maybe paralyzed. Would they say, oh, no, a child has the right to have a father who can run and jump and play with his kids and teach them sports and go on hikes? You know, they'd never say that.
Yeah.
So why is it that these gender roles are so crucial? You know, these assumed gender roles are absolutely necessary, and the children are entitled to them. when they may not exist even in a heterosexual marriage.
Yeah, this argument is just ridiculous to begin with. You're so right. I mean, children are entitled to survival. That's a good thing. And whether it's
survival,
whether it's grandparents or foster parents or adoptive parents or biological parents or siblings or aunts and uncles who are helping that survival happen for that child, we should just be, you know, praising whomever is going to help that child survive. And actually, it also ignores the fact that the most dangerous place right now for a child is in its own home. You know, as far as sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, and the majority of the people doing that are heterosexual people in really crappy relationships, right? Or really like dysfunctional homes. Yeah. And then the whole gender idea is like, what does it mean to be a man? And what does it mean to be a woman? And this is something that's shifting dramatically in our current culture. I mean, even people who are in heterosexual marriages, again, I'll go back to me and my husband. I mean, I don't want to be seen as the docile, quiet, passive nurturer. I mean, what? That does not go over well.
Right.
You know, and he better be tender or else, you know, he's too aggressive. That's not good for him either. So these ideas of what it means to be a man, a successful man, or what it means to be a successful woman, you know, we all have these kind of what are deemed feminine or masculine traits in different ways and in different spectrums. And it's really something that I think is coming under attack from a lot of different narratives, not just the LGBTQ plus narratives.
Right.
So good. All right. And then the families and children argument.
Right. So that one is, basically, again, that the children, it goes along with what we were just talking about, the gender essentialism. There's two aspects to gender essentialism and complementarity. The first is just couples who marry, that, you know, that because of procreation and everything, it takes a man and a woman. And so that's the way God designed for man and woman to be together in marriage. And that's the only way it can be. And then as it relates to children, it's really what we just talked about, which is that the church believes that children are entitled to be raised by a mother and a father. Mm. But as I point out, really, we should turn to the research on this and see what science has to say, and not just on to opinion, because this is really a question that can be addressed by science and by studies. And what the studies show, and which I cite in the report, is that gay couples, and this is still emerging, is because gay marriage is relatively young, but gay couples are just as capable of raising well-adjusted children who, by the way, are going to turn out to be heterosexual or homosexual in the same percentages as the population as a whole. So it doesn't have any impact on that. And really what matters is it's the socioeconomic status and how much time the parent spends with their child and you know, if they love them. Those are the keys to good parenting, not whether
so actually, mother or father. I'll just challenge your wording a little bit. It's not just as good as, they're actually doing a better job than the heterosexual parents because at least at this particular point of time, to be in a homosexual marriage with children, you've got to have a lot of motivation and, like you're saying, resources and time and energy and devotion to make that happen. And so very deliberate parents.
Right. No mistakes or whoops children in those kinds of marriages.
That's right.
That's right.
All right. Do you want to go into some of the moral basis arguments that you make as far as, again, kind of where the church is coming from?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Right. So for the moral basis, now I wanted to examine it just from the position of someone who is trying to come at this from a purely moral reasoning standpoint without religion. So assuming someone who wasn't religious, or maybe they are religious, but they don't know for sure if the church's position is right. And so they just want to examine from a purely right and wrong moral position, what kinds of things do we look at? What do we observe that would tell us whether it's moral or immoral? And I look at several different points. One is love versus sex, because so many people see homosexuality as just being about sex. In mm-hmm. fact, they tend to objectify homosexuals based on their sexuality as opposed to seeing them as whole human beings. I mean, think about if we looked at a young gay couple, a young heterosexual couple in our ward, just say recently married, home after their honeymoon, and they speak and they share their, you know, dating and courtship story, how they often do when they give their talks or testimonies. What if we were to just view them as, oh, wow, they couldn't keep their hands off each other. They're just, you know, burning with lust. That's the only reason that they're together. And, you know, people, all they can think about is what they do and, you know, their bedrooms mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, we don't think that way. That's horrible. But yet, when it comes to gay people, that seems to be the focus. Mm-hmm. In my experience, when I talk to people, is they just cannot get off of gay sex and the sexual aspect of a gay person's relationship. Mm-hmm. They don't see them as being whole human beings who can love and respect and edify and build each other in exactly the same ways that a straight couple can.
Yeah. And I don't know why we're so fixated on this. I mean, heterosexual people have anal sex. Right. Heterosexual people have non-penetrative sex, you know, because I get the whole thing about lesbians too. Like, well, how do they have sex? You don't need a penis to have sex. I mean, I guess you can use a dildo or something like that if you really want something to insert into the vagina. But quite frankly, lots of people have great sex just through manual stimulation, anal stimulation, all of these different things, regardless of who is in the bedroom. Those are things that everybody does. So I think everybody can just take a bit of a chill pill on that. Just assume that people get off in a variety of ways that feel good to them, regardless of who they're with.
Right.
I'm totally with you on that.
Right. Yeah. So the takeaway there is, let's view gay people's relationships the same way we do straight people's relationships, not just as based on sex only. That's yeah. just one aspect of a relationship. Another thing I look at is gut instinct. You know, that's the term for what people feel maybe naturally when they think about being physically affectionate with or intimate with a person of the same sex. They may feel repulsed or, you know, makes them feel sick inside. It's because it feels unnatural to a straight person. Well, did they ever stop to think that to a gay person, you know, thinking about having sex or being intimate with someone of the opposite sex might make them feel the same way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I think straight people seem to naturally project that, you know, same-sex relationships are gross and repulsive because that's the way they feel, but they don't even stop to think that that might be the biological reality for someone, you know, with the homosexual sexual orientation. So,
and I would add to that that repulsion and disgust are not necessarily answers to revelation. In other words, I at some point was very disgusted by the fact that people had sex at all, you know, like when I was 10.
Right. Yep.
So I didn't use that disgust to be an answer from God that all sex was bad.
Right.
But I did eventually, you know, grow into something that had previously disgusted me and no longer disgusts me, you know, and so to not confuse sometimes uncomfortable feelings with answers from God.
Yeah.
Sometimes they are, but not a lot of the times.
Right. Or to assume that that's a moral basis for prohibiting something. Because again, this section is really just trying to look at things, you know, even just aside from religion, what do we know that morally justifies or, you know, objects to homosexual relationships? And so I try to point out gut instinct is really not a good basis for doing that. And if it is a basis, then homosexuals should be able to use their gut instinct to judge their relationships, not to judge straight relationships, in the same way straight people shouldn't use their gut instincts to judge the morality of a homosexual relationship.
Yeah.
Then we have, whether it's natural or unnatural, a lot of people say it's not natural because one, they can't procreate, and two, gay sex is just inherently unnatural, which gets back to, again, really the gut instinct thing.
Mm-hmm. But who gets to define those terms?
Right.
Who gets to define what's natural or unnatural? I mean, yeah. that's the same argument that was used against oral sex for many, many years amongst heterosexuals as well, or masturbation, or many sexual aspects that we consider perfectly normal right. within the human realm.
And there are many things about our life that, you know, may be unnatural, but we don't consider immoral. Whether those are medical procedures, you know, a lot of people thought that in vitro fertilization, when it first came out, oh, that must be against God's will. But now the church really doesn't take a position on it. And I know many members who have been absolutely blessed and grateful for that medical procedure to exist because it's allowed them to have kids. And no one would say that, well, there might be some people that would say it, but most people would not say that because in vitro fertilization is quote unquote unnatural, that makes it immoral.
Yeah. Most of us are living in unnatural worlds. Like we have braces, we have any type of medication you're taking wouldn't have been natural 100 years ago.
Absolutely. One other thing I bring up that I really liked was a story or a movie of a woman who was born without arms. And I remember seeing this as a missionary in the MTC, this little movie, a documentary. And she was a mom, and she bathed her kids. She bottle fed them. She caressed their face all with her feet. And she could drive. She could go grocery shopping. She could cook and peel apples with her feet. It was amazing. And at first it was, as I point out in the paper, it felt a little weird to me and off-putting kind of, because I thought, oh, wow, that just seems so weird and unnatural. But then by the end of it, you know, I felt convicted in my heart for even thinking that, because this woman was inspiring and wonderful. You know, she was born that way and she was able to make the best of, you know, her life and was not prohibited from being a mom and from doing all the things that a person with arms could do. And so even though someone might say, well, it's unnatural to feed your baby or caress your baby's face with your feet, maybe that's not what feet were originally intended for. But guess what? It works. And there's nothing immoral about that.
Right. That's a lovely story. Yes. Okay. And then the last one being harm or benefit.
Right. A lot of people, and including the church, and the doctrinal argument they make is that allowing gay marriage and allowing children to be born into those kinds of families will harm society and will harm the ability for children to form natural attachments and to engage in courtship and marriage. They never cite any reasons why that could be. And I just have no idea how that would happen. Why knowing someone who was in a happy gay marriage would in any way impact my marriage or make me all of a sudden, you know, want to enter into a same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. You know, it really doesn't make sense. On the flip side of that, what is the benefit to having gay people being able to marry and have those same expectations and societal incentives and expectations to pair up and be committed as opposed to engaging in risky sexual behavior and hookup culture and all those things that proper religious society decries? You know, why would we keep them from that? It just, that doesn't make sense. It seems like society will benefit when people can pair up and provide a safety net to each other, can provide care to each other, and, you know, provide a home where they take care of each other and are committed. You know, those are all benefits to society.
Yeah, and this is really also, there's some research that came out last year that really kind of slapped us all in the face as far as religious communities, because they were showing the kids who grow up in non-religious families are actually friendlier and more inclusive than kids who grow up in religious families. So because I think of things like this, right. You know, when we're teaching all the time, like pretty much on a regular weekly or monthly basis, that there's a certain part of the population that is different or not worthy or not, you know, that we should be fighting against, that trickles down.
Right.
And we do that specifically with the LGBTQ population. But you know, I think we do it with other things too, you know, whether somebody's smoking or whether somebody's wearing a bikini or whether somebody, I mean, we have all these markers where kids
right.
come up on,
yeah,
like,
us,
oh,
us
that's
versus
not a
them.
Safe person.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. The evil world and the us versus them. And that's where I think we need to remember that Jesus said we need to be in the world, not of the world.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. And also not to mention, because you mentioned this a little bit in the paper as well, we won't get into it too much, but that marriage in and of itself is a fairly newly, you know, kind of renovated institution. So it's not like we can go back and say, oh yeah, marriage has been this great thing all along, and now it's being ruined by the homosexuals. I mean, marriage was like a place where basically women were owned and right. had no rights and lost their property and lost their custody of their children for, you know, millennia if anything went wrong, or had no options to divorce or had no rights, were basically a slave, enslaved in marriage. So we have a fairly recent, you know, kind of more loving idea of marriage. It's fairly new. So I'm not sure what we're ruining.
Right. Right. Yeah. Love-based egalitarian marriage is a relatively new phenomenon. And actually, as I point out, you know, marriage is on the decline in Europe. It's big time. It's on the decline, and it's on the decline in the U.S. We're kind of following in the same footsteps. But if anything, ironically, gay marriage may be a rejuvenating influence in helping to kind of again enliven and help show what marriage can be.
Yeah. But this is a really important piece, because this is the piece that I'm always speaking to in my blog writings and my positions of advocacy, is really the empirical basis. And so, you know, I love the scripture, by the fruits you shall know them. I think that's set. There's so many beautiful metaphors in all of the gardening scriptures, really, you know, that point us to how we take care of things and whether or not things die or live or bloom or thrive. And so I want to just read the list that you kind of came up with here, because it is a list that I have seen on, and you've seen it by, I think probably with experiences maybe with your own children, but also in your advocacy work, you've had opportunities to talk with many, many people in these positions. And I, from a clinical perspective, have seen this over and over and over again. So you say the fruits of the church's current position in the early stages. So when maybe a teenager is first acknowledging that they're gay or same-sex attracted, and this can happen as early as ages, you know, 7, 8, 9, right. And then, you know, very typically in the 12, 13, 14-year-old stages. So extreme guilt and self-loathing, even when living church standards. So that's very important. So even when they're doing everything right, there's still that extreme guilt and self-loathing just for who they are. Depression and despair with occasional suicidal thoughts. Extreme religiosity and scrupulosity, which is perfectionism and an unhealthy obsession with righteous living and rule keeping in hopes of changing or proving worthiness. So I see this over and over and over again, and so do many of the people that I'm colleagues with. We talk about this often. Now, in the later stages, realizing sexual orientation isn't changing, so that these things aren't working. There's periods of depression and despair with suicidal thoughts, sometimes leading to suicide, social, emotional detachment, inability to form relationships with others, stagnation, apathy, and hopelessness, overcompensation, perfectionism, and overachievement, obsessive compulsive behavior associated with pornography and masturbation, made worse by feelings of shame, worthlessness, and hopelessness. So using those like as a coping strategy, living in a perpetual cycle of shame, trying to suppress innate sexuality and live according to the church's standards, but always falling short, which can fall into like periodic hookups or pornography viewing, etc. Because again, they're trying to suppress this, you know, this complete part of themselves, the sexuality, loss of faith, anger, and bitterness against the church and God. And the vast majority leave the church to eventually preserve emotional and mental health. So that is the current state. That's the fruits of what we are teaching in church.
Right.
And then you share several anecdotes of people who kind of give their stories. So I would encourage everybody to go read. I'll be linking to this article, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. The stories are just so, you know, moving. And I tried to find the stories that to me meant a lot, but you know, I read these stories constantly because I'm in a lot of the different affirmation Facebook groups and other LGBT Facebook groups. And, you know, plus we have our All Arizona in Real Life group. Mm-hmm. And so I meet gay people all the time and hear their stories. And these things that you just described, these fruits of the church's position, are universal. I mean, maybe not 100%, but 99.9%. of the people that I have met and in the stories that I hear go through some or all of these stages. And so we have to ask ourselves, if our position, if we really believe it's of God, then why do we see these fruits? You know, there has to be something wrong either with the gay people or with the church's position. And I don't think it's with the gay people.
Yeah, especially when we see, you know, when they finally leave or choose their emotional well-being over this type of religious living, we see the opposite types of fruits, which we'll get into in a minute. But
right.
I just want to really say that this is why it's no longer tolerable for me to hear things like, well, but that's God's way. Or, you know, like that's the only thought people put into it. Well, that's just the way it is. The prophets have spoken. Their burden.
The thing you always hear is, oh, well, that's just their burden. We all have burdens and crosses to bear and weaknesses in life. And these, you know, this is their burden. But my response is that burden is not something they're born with. The burden is put on them by the church's position. Because once they leave the church, then that burden no longer exists.
All of us saying those things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The burden is put on them by homophobic reaction in society or church or whatever their culture they're in. But, you know, I'm also involved in this parents group who have LGBT kids, and there's over 1,000 now. It's really fast growing, and it's mostly active parents, parents who are active in the church. And almost every story when they introduce themselves, and the kids are coming out younger and younger now. Like my two sons didn't come out until after their mission, publicly anyway. But now the kids are coming out like in the early teens or 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And almost without fail, the parent says, you know, they stopped wanting to go to church. They stopped wanting to go to Mutual. And, you know, I didn't know what was wrong. And then it finally comes out that, you know, they say they're gay or bi or trans. And that just tells us that the kids, you know, no matter how much the church is going to come around and say, well, we need to love gay people, we need to understand them, we need to hear their stories. As long as their position is this thing inside of you, this deep feeling of attraction and desire and wanting to love and have companionship is evil and you can't do it like all of your brothers and sisters and friends and everyone else, you're not allowed. What does that tell these kids? I mean, it's toxic to them. And so most parents ultimately see that that is the case and they do not want their kids going to church because they would rather have a healthy and living gay child, you know, out of the church than a religious, emotionally unhealthy, anguished, tortured, and possibly suicidal child in the church.
That's right.
And so that's generally what I am seeing among parents, even active parents, as much as it hurts them, you know, to have their kids leave the church, they recognize that it's in their best mental health interest.
That's right. That's right. And then you make this list here of people that you've met and know that are partnered and that are comfortable in their orientation and their identity. And the fruits there are happiness and fulfillment, stability and commitment, sincere love and concern for each other. So again, that partnership, when we tell a teen that they can't be partnered with somebody, imagine what that does for all of their relationships. It's not just their romantic relationships, right?
Right.
Again, greater emotional and spiritual well-being, light in their countenance, the fruits of the spirit in their lives. And I love that you use that language, that spiritual language that's ours. It's our Mormon language.
Right.
Because they are not other. That's such a pernicious belief that the spirit will leave when they are able to have these types of relationships and when they're able to own themselves. That is really, I think, such a sin on us as a church to have that belief when we see the opposite and they do have the spirit right in their lives.
That is so true. That's, you know, that's one thing I wish our church leaders who hold so firmly to their position, I wish they would go into the homes of gay married people and gay married people who are active in the church. You wouldn't think there are that many, but there are. And see that countenance and see the light in their countenance and the spirit in their eyes, because it's there. It's quite amazing. And I think that would maybe do more to change their thinking than any, you know, doctrinal exposition or arguing whatever do, is just to associate and be with these people and really see their hearts. I think ultimately that's what tended to make President Kimball question the church's position with respect to Black people in the priesthood and temple, was, you know, once he began getting the stories of the people in Africa and Brazil and, you know, hearing about their lives and their experiences, that changed his heart.
Yeah, and I know that the current presidency and apostles have heard the stories. I know that there have been people just like you who've actually met with them and told them about their children, the suicides, people who are trying to, who are getting married. So it's a little bit, what word do I want to use, uncomfortable or disheartening for me that that hasn't had more of an impact. And so I would like to see what you're talking about, which is actually go into the homes. And for any members of the church that might feel in disagreement with many of the things that we've said here, again, just an invitation to get to know people who are gay, who are lesbian, who are married, who are in relationships. That's usually how we make progress in the world, right? Whether it's...
That's absolutely the key. That's what's going to change people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting to know people that you're afraid of or that you other. So, all right. So where do we go from here? Do you want to take us home with what are you hoping, what are you hoping happens? And what, I mean, you've kind of been saying it all along as far as your key, but let's wrap it up with.
Yeah. So as I pointed out, the church is making some positive steps. It certainly reversed some horrible teachings and doctrines from, you know, a generation ago. And, you know, those are all positive steps. And even in just the last year or two, we've seen a lot of positive things happen. We've seen negative things happen as well. There's been kind of an inconsistent approach, and that was likely due to President Monson being incapacitated and so not having a unified voice in this area. But it'll be interesting to see now what that unified voice is. But Elder Ballard, like recently in November of last year, gave that fireside where he said, there is a place for you in the church, you know, as a gay person, and we need to listen to their stories and hear about their lives. So that was a very positive thing. Now, as I just pointed out, while getting rid of homophobia in the church, telling people that being gay is not a choice, telling people to love and have empathy for our gay brothers and sisters is a good step, it's not enough, because as long as kids from the time they're little have drilled into their souls that they, if they ever act on that, you know, deep inner desire that we all have as human beings to connect with and be with and partner with someone else, you know, that we are naturally attracted to, as long as they're told that they can't have that and that if they express that, it will cause the downfall of the family and society. You know, it's toxic to them. It causes them, you know, mental and emotional anguish, and it's unhealthy. So the only way I see that we can correct that is we need a revelation from God to tell us how do we correct that, or, you know, the way we are going is not right. You know, one or the other. And so that is going to take a lot of courage. It's going to take a lot of humility, because the church will have to clearly backtrack on what it's taught now very strongly for several years, but it won't be the first time, particularly with blacks in the priesthood. There were, you know, every prophet since Brigham Young pretty much taught that this was God's will, that, and, you know, this isn't going to change until, you know, the millennium or who knows when. And a lot of them had to, you know, swallow their pride. Elder McConkie's famous speech when he said, forget what Brigham Young said, forget what Orson Pratt said, forget whatever I said. We acted and spoke with limited light and knowledge. And before we understood what is, and I'm paraphrasing this, you know, before we knew what was recently revealed today, you know, this was back in 1978. So the church can change, and it has changed on pretty much every fundamental doctrine. If we study the doctrines, we'll see that from the beginning of the church until now, there have been numerous changes to many of the fundamental doctrines. So
from everything from polygamy to birth control to,
I mean, even just the nature of God, from the way Joseph Smith originally conceived of God, from one being to, you know, a bodied God. I mean, that changed over time. He didn't just have that all at once. So a lot of the doctrines that we have in the church change over time as we get more light and knowledge. And that's the hallmark of a living church. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It doesn't mean that God changes. It means that we are coming to understand what is really God's will and what is eternal truth. And that's,
which is the hallmark of Mormonism.
Exactly. Yeah. We believe all that God has revealed, all that he does now reveal, and that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom.
That's right. It's what sets us apart, and it's beautiful. And we've done it many, many times, and I guess we'll do it many, many more times to come, even on topics that are not of this subject. But this is an obviously important subject for you. You have two gay sons. It's an important subject to me. I've had many, many people in my office. I've known, you know, people who've died from suicide in this regard. I mean, it's tragic. It's unnecessary. It's harmful. It's abusive. And it needs to end. And we can be members of the church and hold that position. I feel, you know, more Mormon than ever holding this position. And I will not have anybody say differently of me because I hold a position that is opposing the current position that, you know, some of my leaders are espousing. And I even sustain them through that, you know, disagreement. That's my position on that. I'm not going to, for me, just bowing down and whatever you say goes. That's not a sustaining position. That's a blind sheep position that I don't think helps anybody. I don't want people treating me like that. If anything I say goes, then I lose reality. I need people to challenge me and tell me where I'm wrong in my thinking and be willing to stand up and say, I don't think you've got that, Natasha, exactly right. And that to me would feel much more sustaining, albeit uncomfortable. And I might get a little defensive, but it's still more sustaining than just going along with me. So thank you so much, Bryce, for this wonderful interview, for your work on this. I think it's really an important piece. And I hope that people will take the time to really, you know, dig into it and read it and share it with others, and that this will have been a good podcast to also maybe share with those that you're, you know, hoping that will be open to different ways of thinking about this topic, because I think really for the primary reason of the suffering of so many.
Right.
Any closing thoughts from you or?
Well, I want to thank you for having me on and allowing me to share this paper. And as I expressed, I just hope, if anything, that it causes people to think and to really consider the questions that it raises, and that they might get their own inspiration on the subject and not just rely on what they're told and what cultural tradition and belief has been over the ages, but that they really come to understand what it means to be gay. And ideally, if they would really come to know gay people and see what their lives are, I think that would do more than anything to change hearts and lives. So thank you again for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bryce, for your time. I really appreciate you being on. Good night.
Good night.
And for those of you who are listening, just again, if you find these types of podcasts valuable, remember to donate. Please consider commenting on the comment section. We'd love to hear from you. What types of topics do you want me to cover? What did you like or did not like about this interview? We'd just love to stay engaged. So please donate, comment, be involved, and continue listening. Thank you so much.
Took the long road home, turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary But through every storm, we traveled on like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love you. An ordinary, extraordinary some people say, love is blind, and forever it's too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise, can't imagine life alone. Until we're gone, won't you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond. It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. Extraordinary, it's nothing ordinary love. Ordinary, no, it's extraordinary.